cap while playing baseball, to his great disgust. He was then assigned to limited service with the Army Medical Corps, entertaining hospitalized servicemen. He was shuttled around to a variety of California Army camps and finally phoned me from Watsonville. "I'm going to be in Birmingham, honey," he said, sounding very depressed.
"Gee, that's great," I replied. "I'm leaving for a bomb tour in the East next week, and I'll come to Alabama to see you."
"Birmingham, California," he groaned, naming an Army hospital not 5 miles from the ranch. At the hospital, Desi did a fine job with the boys back from Bataan and Corregidor and Tarawa. He organized shows and saw that the troops had movies and radios and books, plus access to all kinds of sports and gym equipment. He helped them with their letters and ordered candy and cigarettes for their rooms. He often put on one-man shows for them playing drums and guitar, and when I could get away, I joined him and we presented our old vaudeville act. Desi was dedicated to these wounded kids and won many commendations for his fine work. But it galled him not to be overseas himself. He was allowed to leave the hospital every night and on weekends, which turned out to be unfortunate. He was too close to Hollywood. Social life in Hollywood in those days revolved around the studio producers and executives. When Louis B. Mayer deserted his wife in 1944 and moved into Marion Davies' former mansion in Beverly Hills to live high, dozens of other Hollywood bigwigs left their wives and followed suit. Mayer and his friends took up gambling, horse racing, yachting, and parties in a big way, and Sergeant Desi went right along with them. I told Desi that it was all right for some executive or producer in a high financial bracket to join Mr. Mayer in his lively games. They could afford it. But no one approves of an actor enjoying wild parties and late nights. It's too exhausting and shows up immediately in the face and the voice before a camera. I kept telling Desi that these were his bosses and they would have no respect for his reliability and talents as an actor if all they ever saw was a charming, irresponsible playboy. In 1944, Desi was still under contract to MGM. My dearest hope was that we could co-star in a movie after the war. I told movie reporter Gladys Hall, "The only bad feature of this past incredibly wonderful year is that I haven't had Desi. I don't begrudge him to the service, but I miss him. When Desi comes back, I don't believe there is any doubt but that MGM will realize that in him they have one of the biggest bets in the business. Why, after he made one picture at RKO, his fan mail was second only to Ginger Rogers. And even now, after having been away a year, he still gets 200 and 300 fan letters a week." 9. During World War II, I was rushed from one extravagant musical to the next with the full star treatment at MGM. This was the heyday of the movies. It was hard to keep a level head and one's sense of values. MGM made overworked, spoiled idols out of Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, and Elizabeth Taylor. And it wasn't the kids' fault, nor the studios. It was the system. I, too, was on the spoiling list for a while, but I didn't go along with it. The studio wanted me to appear at the boss's parties and entertain them in return. They didn't approve of the image I created, living alone at the ranch, in dungarees, catering to dogs and cats and my decrepit chickens. When the day's work was done, I would slip away from the studio as quickly and quietly as I could. The San Fernando Valley was green, open spaces then, with rolling horse ranches and walnut and citrus groves. The hour ride to and from the ranch was my thinking time, the necessary break for reflection. Desi came home less and less, and I was soon caught up in bond tours. A group of us would fly to some city like Philadelphia and make 42 appearances in a week to 10 days. Desi and I communicated more by long distance than in person. It was a strange, lonely, unreal kind of life. I clipped out a picture of an adorable baby from a magazine and pasted it along with my movie reviews in my scrapbook. Underneath the baby's smile, I wrote, "I don't see any pictures of me in this book, and this is your 3rd year of marriage. Quit kidding." In 1943, I made Meet the People with Dick Powell. I was a clothes horse again in this one, a famous actress who becomes a welder in a factory, to meet the people. It wasn't a good movie, but
I enjoyed working with Dick. He was a great, natural performer. He was so natural that he was not always given the credit he deserved. Dick didn't make noise about his acting or his marriage troubles or even his losing fight with cancer. A sane, sensible, stoic man. He was also a loving husband and father and a showman of rare ability. In January 1944, my grandfather, Freddie, my beloved daddy, died of a stroke at 78. We never even considered burying him in Hollywood. He belonged next to Floribel in the elm-shaded Hunt family plot in Jamestown. I flew east for his funeral and then stayed at the Jamestown Hotel for several days, seeing old friends and helping raise money for a war bond drive. I told local newspapermen that Desi was still the number one interest in my life and that I hoped to co-star in a picture with him after the war. Telephone calls and telegrams from Desi flooded the hotel during my four-day stay, and everyone assumed we were still honeymooning. Then I returned to Hollywood to make Ziegfeld Follies. This was a great, glittering, lavish production of Arthur Freed's with many top stars, including Fred Astaire, Judy Garland, Lena Horne, and Gene Kelly. I was promised that I could dance with Fred Astaire and do some Bee Lily-type sketches, but it was such a stupendous production involving so many egos and temperaments that I ended up doing nothing but cracking a rhinestone-studded whip over eight Black Panthers. Ziegfeld Follies got terrible reviews. It was a costly dud lacking all sparkle and originality. Once again, I learned the bitter lesson that directors and producers can make or break an actress. I was a star, but I felt that I couldn't afford to turn down parts for fear of infuriating these bigwigs. Who does she think she is, putting her judgment above ours? If I did turn down a script, which I never did while under contract, I would be put on suspension without salary. I couldn't accept an offer from any other studio, no matter how good, yet I could be fired at any time without the bosses showing cause. In some ways, it was wonderful to be a contract player under the wing of a powerful studio, but at the same time, it was a master-serf relationship. All the glittering stars were at the mercy of the whims of the top people. The studio executives and producers were the in-group. The writers and actors and directors were the out-group. The major war was between the in and the out-groups, but equally savage wars raged within. I knew I had the ability, and I set myself to learn a difficult and demanding craft with as much self-discipline as I could muster. Most people at RKO and MGM knew I had something, but nobody knew quite what. They made the mistake of giving me gags, whereas I find my comedy is in the tradition of pure physical comedy. I must be given a comic situation, which I live with, tussle with, and then the twists and complications emerge. At MGM during the war years, the producers were always in love with a different girl every day of the week, and some of the things that were planned for me were given to other actresses. I didn't particularly care. My tiny part in Ziegfeld Follies was a disappointment, but I went on to play a supporting role in Without Love, starring Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. It was tremendously exciting to be in a picture with Hepburn, whom I had admired so much at RKO. Katie seemed to lead a lonely life, but she is probably the least lonely woman I know. She is also one of those rare persons secure enough to disregard convention and yet retain her sense of dedication and self-respect. Spencer Tracy is a brooding, strange man with a great depth of feeling for those close to him. In his leisure moments, Spence is relaxed and can be extremely entertaining. On the set, he is all business. When you're working with Spencer, you don't kid around. Without Love was based on the Philip Barry play about a young widow who wants to keep bright the memory of a perfect marriage and a love-weary scientist who is marriage-shy. In my supporting role, Bosley Crowther noted, "Lucille Ball throws wisecracks like baseballs." While I was knocking myself out with movie making and bond tours, my marriage was crashing fast. Desi's nightlife had even blasé Hollywood talking. Confidential magazine published a story about a Palm Springs weekend of his. and this too hurt and humiliated me deeply. At a Birmingham hospital picnic that summer, Desi got roaring drunk and called his superior officer some pretty unprintable names. I was sure he'd be busted from sergeant to private, but because he was doing such a fine job with the wounded men, he was let off with a reprimand. Desi never could accept authority easily. During the summer of 1944, Desi stopped coming home. One night, I tossed sleeplessly until dawn, wondering where our marriage had gone awry and what I had done wrong. Finally, I hit upon a desperate measure. I still loved Desi. He was the only man in my life. But I decided to divorce him. I chose California because a divorce there takes a year to become final, and therefore, there were 365 days left for a reconciliation. Cleo was married and living in an army camp in North Carolina, and Dee Dee was visiting her there. I telephoned them to say I was divorcing Desi. "Well, it's too bad you can't work things out," Cleo commented. "You two have so much going for you." "I know that," I agreed. "But now Desi's even blaming me for the war." The night before I was scheduled to make my appearance in court, Desi showed up. He was contrite and his most charming self. The next morning, I climbed out of our big double bed and started to put on a suit, picture hat, and jewelry. "Where are you going?" Desi wanted to know. "To court, to divorce you," I told him. I told the judge that Desi had caused me grievous mental suffering. I didn't expect Desi to be around when I got back to the ranch later that morning, but he was. He looked white and stricken. "Lucy," he said, "the next time I marry, I'm going to be a better husband." "And the next time I marry, I'm going to be a better wife," I answered truthfully. Desi's face brightened. "Then why don't we both try it on each other?" he suggested. I didn't believe Desi could change, but he did for a time. I gulped a bit when I paid $2,000 in fees for the divorce I never got, but it was worth it. For a long time, Desi came home every night, and we both tried very hard to make things work. I no longer expected to be as happy as I had been as an ecstatic new bride, but I did look for a measure of peace and security. I closed my eyes, put blinders on, and ignored what was too painful to think about. I tried to view my troubles less seriously and worry less. I tried to curb my temper. Things said in embarrassment and anger are seldom the truth, but are said to hurt and wound the other person. Once said, they can never be taken back. During this period of reconciliation, a reporter asked Desi what adjustment he had contributed to our marriage. He fell into a prolonged silence, then finally came up with two. "Well, I try to sleep with the damn windows open because Lucy likes fresh air. Then I took up square dancing for a while. I went around jumping with the rest of the characters." Around this time, my good friend director Eddie Bazell asked for me for his picture Easy to Wed. This was a remake of an early Jean Harlow movie, Libeled Lady, and one of the highlights of my movie career. The plot concerned a rich playgirl, Esther Williams, who sues a newspaper for a libelous story about her. The paper hires a great lover, Van Johnson, to compromise her so that the suit will be forgotten. I played a showgirl again, in ringlets, black tights, and short bustle, but instead of being the hard-boiled type with all the answers, I was an unsophisticated poor soul, a chorus girl who was being used and stepped on and was fighting back in her own way. Eddie Bazell put me at my ease and encouraged me to be myself in a way no other director had done before. I was sick and tired of drop-gag parts where I strolled through a room, dropped an acidly humorous remark, and left. Eddie, who came to Hollywood through the Orpheum vaudeville circuit, used to attend our parties at the ranch. He had seen me do my silly chicken dance with our flock of ancient hens. He saw the potential in me for humor and pathos I didn't even know I had. I had a driving, consuming ambition to succeed in show business, but I had no idea where my real talents lay. I was dying to be told, to be shown. Way down deep underneath those brassy showgirl trappings was Lucy. And there she stayed, strangulated, for years. Easy to Wed was released to sterling reviews, After knocking myself out, giving my best possible performance in this picture, I expected other good roles to follow. Instead, I was put into a real dog with John Hodiak called Two Smart People. At least the critics knew how to call it. The New York Times described Two Smart People as a dog-eared tale about love and the confidence racket. Lucille Ball plays the beauteous dame who falls for the guy she started out to fleece. She is painfully defeated by the script at every turn. But in addition to its pedestrian plot, Two Smart People suffers from a lack of competent direction. In November 1945, Desi was released from the Army and hurried home to take up his interrupted movie career. He hoped to have an excellent part in a movie called Fiesta, but MGM had been grooming Ricardo Montalban in Desi's absence and gave it to him instead. We talked long and seriously about what Desi should do. Since nothing seemed cooking in the movies for him, he turned to his next love, music. He asked for his release from MGM and started to put together a rumba band. Nothing seemed to be working out for either of us. My movie career seemed just as stalled at MGM as it had been at RKO. I was making $3,500 a week, but I wasn't getting anywhere. The years were speeding by. I was still childless, and my dream of co-starring with Desi and working side by side as a team seemed hopeless. Whenever I could, I went to Desi's nightclub openings, but I didn't enjoy them much. If I watched him too closely, I was accused of being there to keep an eye on him. If I didn't appear, I was taunted with concentrating too much on my own career. I blame a lot of my troubles at MGM on the agent I had at the time. Now, I had always been aware that until you get to a certain point in your career, no agent can help you. You have to advance yourself. By this time, however, at $3,500 weekly, I was near the top of the heap financially. But I soon learned that my agent had little regard for me as a person or a performer, and when the chips were down, he was not on my side. All my affairs were being handled by this agent, and I wanted to have a serious discussion with him about what I was doing. What was going to further my career? What kinds of roles were good or bad for me? But he couldn't be bothered. And the next thing I knew, I had been loaned out to a totally strange studio without my consent or even my knowledge. The movie was The Dark Corner for 20th Century Fox with Mark Stevens, Clifton Webb, and William Bendix. 20th Century was paying $6,000 a week for my services, but I only got a portion of this. MGM and my agent pocketed the difference. This in itself infuriated me. On my first day of work, Harriet and I drove to the 20th Century Studios. We passed a place near our ranch where a ragged mongrel pup was chained up. I'm kind of a nut on the subject of cruelty to animals. I was upset to see this dog chained in the hot sun without shelter or water. He raced back and forth in a frenzied desperation as we drove by, almost breaking his neck. Harriet noticed that I turned very white and began to tremble. For some reason, that lonely pup really got to me that day. The experience left me oddly off balance. Looking back, I think I must have been going through a mild nervous breakdown at this time. On the weekends, Desi would sit beside the pool most of the day, depressed and miserable. "Look at him," I'd tell Dee Dee, "brooding again." "It's not good for a man when the woman's the breadwinner of the family," Dee Dee replied calmly. What could I say? I believed this, too. My brother Freddie and cousin Cleo were having difficulties around this time, and Dee Dee accused me of helping them too much. "You're so strong that you do too much for those you love," she scolded me. "That weakens them and lets them slide." I was trying to be a good trooper, a good neighbor, and a sister and wife. I was trying as hard as I could, but everything seemed to be going wrong, and everyone was blaming me. When I fluffed my lines on the set the next week, and the director said sharply, "Lucy, have you been drinking?" I'd never in my life been accused of such a ridiculous thing. I needed sympathy, understanding, help, but was met only with coldness and hostility. I complained to my agent. "I don't know what's happening on that set, but they're accusing me of all kinds of things." He replied coldly, "Well, from what I hear, what are you doing?" Well, that's all I needed. So I said, "Why don't you come on the set and see if I don't know my lines or if I'm wasting time?" So that day, my agent bothered to show up. But it was too late. I was so unstrung, I couldn't get a word out. I'd never had any trouble with my work before, and to be suddenly called a slacker was more than I could take. "I want Mark. I want Mark," I cried over and over. I wanted Mark Rabwin. Dr. Rabwin was not only my doctor and one of the finest surgeons in the country, he was my mentor, my friend. I needed someone who would come and help me. So by this time, everyone on the set was alarmed, and they phoned Mark and Dee Dee, and they both came over and took me home. This was highly unusual behavior for me. I've never forgotten that moment. Today, if anyone gets unpleasant with me on the set, I say, "Hey, what was that?" If I've done something wrong, let's deal with it directly. Don't be snide or sarcastic. And I try to remain sensitive to others' feelings on the set. You never know what else people are dealing with in their lives and how those pressures might be affecting their performance. But of course I'm in a different position now. They only pick on you when you can be picked on. After you reach a certain level, they wouldn't dare treat you so rudely. As for my own mini breakdown, I realize now that I had been trying to embrace too much, taking on too many burdens, emotional and financial. As a result, I was exhausted, just completely depleted in every way. This made me unsure of myself and unstrung. I had enough technical skill to turn in a good performance regardless, and The Dark Corner was hailed as tough-fibered, exciting entertainment with superior performances. I can't say my performance was superior. I look utterly bemused in this movie, with a staring, numb fog bank look as if I were being driven into a dark corner. I was a very sick girl for 3 months afterward. I was having a terrible time with Desi, and my agent had me sewn up so tight that the only way I could get him out of my life was to leave MGM. I regretted this keenly. But it was the only legal way in which I could get rid of that agent's representation. Afterward, I swore I would never again be packaged out to anybody without my say-so, and I never was. The day I left MGM, I went up to Louis B. Mayer's impressive front office to say goodbye. The movie industry's most powerful tycoon was still living it up, and our paths rarely crossed outside the studio gates. He said he was very sorry to see me go. I said goodbye to my friends on the lot and left the studio for good, I thought. I was terribly depressed. Life seemed unbearable. Desi was away rounding up a new band, so I sat home alone and cried. I was still stuttering, and this terrified me. Then one day, Kurt Frings, a well-known agent, drove the 25 miles out from Hollywood to our ranch to see me. He told me that Olivia de Havilland had sent him. She had heard about my difficulties and thought perhaps he could help me. I hardly knew Olivia except to say hello. I was bowled over by her kindness. Olivia de Havilland had been involved in the same kind of package dealing with the same agent that had been representing me. She had refused roles and had been put on suspension. Olivia fought a bitter 18-month court battle with the agent and won. Because she courageously fought the system, we all benefited. Kurt Frings suggested that I freelance, and in fact, he had a picture all ready for me at Universal. I can't, I told him. All I do is stutter. Frings kept talking to me, quietly and soothingly, and almost persuaded me to do Lover Come Back with George Brent. Then the director, Bill Sighter, called and said, "You're a great gal. We need you. Come on over to Universal and go to work." "I can't read a line," I told him. Bill said, "Of course you can." I went over to Universal, and he laughed at me for 3 days while I stuttered. By the fifth day, I was talking with no difficulty. Lover Came Back got poor reviews, but it saved me. Howard Barnes of the New York Herald Tribune wrote, "Our sympathy to Miss Ball, who is fetching in Travis Banton's gowns in spite of the plot's ennui." Bosley Crowther said, "Miss Ball wears a wardrobe of costumes and acts as if she really had a script. The poor lady is sadly deluded. She is completely without support." But although the scriptwriters were viewed to have failed me, the director and the other players did not. Making Lover come back was the best thing I could have done. I will never forget the understanding and help Bill Sider gave me when I needed it most. I will always be grateful. And George Brent was a wonderfully supportive co-star. While I was making Lover come back in the spring of 1946, Desi and his band opened to enthusiastic reviews at Ciro's. His next engagement was at the Copacabana in New York. For the first time in 11 years, I was not under contract to a studio and was free to take an extended vacation. I took 6 months off. Desi and I boarded a train for New York along with Harriet and Desi's 16 band members. We took a big apartment at the Delmonico Hotel at 59th Street and Park Avenue. Desi and I had a ball. He had to play at the Copa most of the night and liked to sleep until noon. When I got up at my usual early hour, I'd lock the bedroom door so the hotel maids wouldn't go in and disturb him. One day, Dee Dee phoned me from California and said, "What's this I read in Sheila Graham's column? It says here you lock Desi out of the bedroom and he pounds on the door and shouts and hollers." "What?" I said. "That's a pack of lies." I called Sheila Graham, hopping mad, and demanded a retraction. "Lucy, I wouldn't write something like that unless it came on good authority." She finally admitted that someone in the hotel had tipped her off. Then I figured out how it all started. It was summertime, and our bedroom was on an inner court with the windows open. Harriet and I would often go shopping in the morning, and once, when we got back, Desi was awake, banging on the locked bedroom door and yelling, "Lucy! Lucy! The door's locked!" Somebody on the court heard this and reported it to Sheila, who printed it without checking. She's never forgotten how furious I was. But Desi and I were so happily reconciled that I wanted nothing to spoil it, least of all an incorrect item in a gossip column. This year, 1946, was the movie's peak year, when some 90 million people went to the movies every week. It was also the year that five of my movies were playing on Broadway at the same time. When I lunched with old friends at Mama Leone's, I was mobbed by fans with autograph books. It was my first experience being a New York celebrity, and I found it unsettling, especially when hordes of teenagers with pads and pencils sprang out at me everywhere. "The little rascals are a menace," I remarked to a reporter, diving into a 1 a.m. breakfast at 21. The reporter asked me about my experience making The Dark Corner, which was being premiered that day. "What's it all about?" I asked the interviewer. "Honestly, I have no idea what the story is. Most of my scenes were with Mark Stevens, and I never did know what the rest of the people were doing. I guess I'll have to go see it." I could almost hear the 20th Century Press agent grinding his teeth, and I chuckled inwardly. I hoped that the movie, which gave me such trouble, would be a bomb. Actually, it did quite well. The only picture of the five on Broadway I really cared about was Easy to Wed, the comedy I did with Eddie Buzzell at MGM. I went to see this with musical comedy star Jane Keen, who was then appearing in the Broadway show Are You With It? I had only just met the attractive and vivacious Jane, but liked her immediately. "It's such a pleasure to know you, Miss Ball," she said very formally when we were introduced. "Well, you'll know me all my life," I answered. Jane and I have been close ever since. The day we went to see Easy to Wed at the Palace in New York, there was a long line of people waiting. I had just come from dining with Desi at the Copacabana and was wearing a cocktail dress and a Lily Dachet hat of turquoise feathers. When Jane and I got out of the cab, I joined the end of the line on 50th Street, three blocks from the theater. Jane was amazed. "You're the star of this movie. Why don't you see the manager and he'll let you right in," she suggested. "Oh, I don't want to do that," I told her. "Supposing I say, I'm Lucille Ball," and he says, "So what?" Jane looked at me and shook her head. "And to think I took you for a domineering female." Finally, Jane went into the theater, and fortunately, the manager laid down the red carpet for both of us. I guess I couldn't forget all my abortive attempts to get into a vaudeville act on that same palace stage back in my early days in New York. While I was vacationing in New York, I was invited to Jamestown to help raise money for the little theater. The town fathers asked me what kind of benefit party I'd like, and I suggested a boat ride on the SS City of Jamestown to Chautauqua. I didn't realize that they'd have to raise the old steamboat from the bottom of the lake. But they did. And then during the ride, every time I'd move from port to starboard to enjoy another familiar view of the lake, everyone on board would follow me, and the boat would list dangerously low on that side. The captain kept saying, "Everybody stay in the middle of the boat." But it was a beautiful moonlit trip. "There's no other place in the world like Jamestown," I told the local reporter. "They'll tell you that California is God's country, but God's country is right here in Jamestown. I can't possibly tell you how much this place means to me because of the normal, happy childhood it gave me and offers to every youngster." The only thing that disturbed me about the visit was that some of my old friends didn't show up. They were timid about meeting a movie star. When they did see me, they jumped to the other side of the street in confusion, and a few stood there with a big chip on their shoulder, waiting for me to knock it off. I finally put an ad in the paper asking my old friends to stop by the hotel, but it took another 10 years for me to have a real homecoming in Jamestown. 10. Our New York idol couldn't last forever. Desi got pretty busy. He made Cuban Pete for Universal in 1946. He was also musical director for Bob Hope's radio show, and the rest of the time he toured the United States and Canada. Desi was well acquainted with performing in the best night spots in New York and Miami. Now he learned how people reacted to his showmanship in Kalamazoo and Chagrin Falls. He was well-liked wherever he went, and clubs and theaters were always happy to have him back. Other bandleaders respected his talents and knew that he ran a well-paid outfit. Even if he ended up with nothing after a particular engagement, Desi always saw that his boys were taken care of. At Vegas, Desi made the most money, but generally left it behind. One night, he dropped $48,000 at the gambling tables. But, as we'd established from the first days of our marriage, his finances were his own business. He ran his band in his own way, and in a few years he was netting $2,500 a week. Desi eventually got sick of running around the country for one-night stands, but he never got sick of leading a band, because he loves music. When he sits at the conga drum, pounding out those pulse-racing rhythms, his smile is ecstatic, his great dark eyes glow. That's when he's happiest. That said, starting a band from scratch and trying to build a national reputation isn't easy. During the first year, when money was pretty tight, several of his musicians fell ill and had to be hospitalized. Desi could have replaced the sick men with other players and continued on his tour. Instead, he canceled several engagements and dug deep into his reserve funds to pay both his idol musicians and a pile of medical bills. While Desi was on the road, I hired a tutor and studied literature and languages 3 nights a week. I made My Awful Wife and Her Husband's Affairs for Columbia with French Autonne, and Lured for United Artists. In Lured, a routine whodunit, I played a taxi dancer in London who is used as criminal bait by Scotland Yard. George Sanders played opposite me, and Charles Coburn and Sir Cedric Hardwicke had supporting roles. Around this time, June Havoc was staying with us at the ranch. She's such a bright, warm, fun-loving person who I thoroughly enjoyed having around. One day, she said to me, "Lucy, I know you're going stir-crazy. Why don't you take a big chunk of time, now that Desi's away and you're freelancing, tour the country with a play?" Soon afterward, two producers who were running the Princeton Drama Festival that summer talked me into doing Dream Girl. Havoc, as we all referred to her, had appeared in this Elmer Rice play on Broadway, and she thought it would be a good vehicle for me. It was the first chance I'd had in years to get away from Hollywood, and of course, to me, the stage had always been it. We opened in Princeton's MacArthur Theater in June 1947, and ended up touring the whole country, big towns and small, for 27 weeks, or almost 7 months, much longer than I had expected. Dream Girl was a tour de force written especially for Betty Field, who was great in it, but it gave me a chance to demonstrate some versatility, a chance Hollywood kept denying me. The reviews were warm and welcoming. One night, two gentlemen came backstage and introduced themselves as my former teachers at the John Murray Anderson Dramatic School in New York. They congratulated me warmly on my performance and said that they had recognized my potential years ago. That gave me a chuckle. But I was pleased, too. I didn't take the opportunity to remind them that I'd been kicked out of their school for lack of talent. During my tour, Desi's busload of musicians had a terrible accident near LaPorte, Indiana, when the bus driver fell asleep at the wheel at 85 miles an hour. One of the boys lost an eye, and some of the others were badly cut up. My brother, Freddie, was their band manager, and both he and Desi narrowly missed being killed because they decided to charter a plane to catch me and Dreamgirl in Detroit that day. Fate was certainly looking out for them, because only 6 men of the 16-piece orchestra were unhurt. The 2 who took over Desi and Freddie's regular seats up front were hurt the worst. One of them, Charlie Harris, broke many bones, and he was the one who lost an eye. Desi immediately flew back to join the band. They had a date to keep that night in Akron, Ohio, and a cancellation would have cost him dearly. But news of the accident spread, and a half a dozen competing bands came to Desi's rescue. They sent a pianist, a whole trumpet section, drummers, and maraca players to Akron to replace the injured musicians. Desi never forgot that. "Helping the fellow who's in a tough spot is the best thing about America," he always said. On January 6, 1948, we brought Dreamgirl to Los Angeles after performances in Boston, Detroit, Milwaukee, and many other cities. It was expensive to bring the large cast and the scenery from the East Coast. I wound up contributing to the move to Hollywood for the sake of our cast's newer actors, kids who wanted to be seen where it might count. The show ended in Los Angeles after most of the cast was felled by a terrible virus, including me. In 1948, the movie industry was in a panic. The year before, MGM had gone $6,500,000 into the red. Now budgets were being slashed and the number of contract players cut in half, and the spate of productions dwindled to a trickle. All over the country, movie theaters were closing as customers went elsewhere or stayed home with a radio, and a new threat, television. Like many of my colleagues, I began to cast a speculative eye toward radio. Back in 1946, Hubble Robinson of CBS, vice president in charge of programming, had talked to me about a domestic comedy show based upon the book Mr. and Mrs. Cugat. I was interested, especially if Desi could co-star, but the big brass at CBS thought he was not the type to play a typical American husband. "But he is my husband," I told them, "and I think it helps make a domestic comedy more believable when the audience knows the couple are actually married." I knew, too, that radio interfered less with a normal home life than any other entertainment medium, a fact borne out by the experiences of such happily married radio greats as Mary Livingston and Jack Benny, Fred Allen and Portland Hoffa, Gracie Allen and George Burns, and Harriet and Ozzie Nelson. But CBS turned a deaf ear to my proposal to team me up with Desi. So, finally, I relented and did a series with Richard Denning called My Favorite Husband, based on the Cugat book. This half-hour weekly show was similar to I Love Lucy, only in that I played a wacky wife. I was married to the 5th vice president of a bank and trying in comic ways to promote his career. Gail Gordon was the bank president, the same role that was to be his on the Lucy show. I found radio a wonderful way to make a lot of extra money. It was easy because although we had a studio audience, I could read the script. I didn't have to memorize it. If I was busy on a movie set during the day, we'd rehearse and tape at night. Radio was very big then in Hollywood, and everyone in the movie industry was getting into it. My writers on My Favorite Husband were Madeline Pugh, Bob Carroll Jr., and producer-director Jess Oppenheimer, a connection that would become particularly fruitful in years to come. Jess Oppenheimer had written for several radio stars, including Jack Benny, Edgar Bergen, and Fanny Bryce. He assured me that the audiences would laugh if I looked directly at them rather than down at the words. I didn't believe him until he sent me to see a Jack Benny show. For the first time, I realized how Jack could make a funny remark and then, simply by gazing deadpan at the audience, sustain the laughter another 45 seconds. Our commercial sponsor, Jell-O, wanted me to do some funny nursery rhyme commercials at the end of the program, and taking my cue from Jack Benny, I began to mug, use my body, and turn directly to the audience. It worked. In 1949, Desi and I instituted a stay-at-home policy. I was still childless, which caused me great heartache. Freddie and Cleo were both married and had kids of their own. I had dogs and cats. So one day, Jesse and I sat in our cabbage rose papered living room and talked far into the night. We finally decided that Desi would give up his cross-country tours and only take local engagements with his band. We would both consult doctors to see why we did not have children. And we would kick out the bums. Desi had many hangers-on at our ranch at this time. Drinking, brawling, constantly dropping in, they gave us no peace. We had to take over our own home again, losing the parasites for good. I told Desi that I would try to be a better wife, more loving, more understanding. To prove that I really meant to make a major effort, I started taking instruction in the Catholic faith. I thought that because Desi and I had eloped and had been married by a judge, our marriage somehow lacked a certain sacred quality. So we were married again in 1949 in Our Lady of the Valley Church in Canoga Park. Groucho Marx couldn't make the ceremony, but he wired, "What's new?" Desi and his band were appearing on Hollywood Sunset Strip the June day we remarried. He wore a white suit, and I was in a blue satin wedding dress with a bridal bouquet. My mentor in comedy techniques, Ed Sedgwick, gave me away, and Desi's mother, Dolores, was matron of honor. I thought it would please her to have us married in the church, and I promised to bring up any children we might have as Catholics. It was a sentimental occasion with our closest friends and family there, and a wedding reception afterward. It was a beautiful ceremony, and I believed in it. At the time, I seriously intended to become a Catholic. I took instruction for a long time, but lost the inspiration when I realized that Catholicism did not seem to help Desi in his life. In 1949, I signed a contract with Columbia for one picture a year. Desi did a picture for Columbia that same year called Holiday in Havana, and was still Bob Hope's musical director on his radio show. His band was now so successful that he was getting $12,000 a week for appearances, and I was very proud of him. This year was the beginning of my great association with Bob Hope. We did Sorrowful Jones together, a remake of the Damon Runyon story Little Miss Marker, which originally starred Shirley Temple. Going to Bob's set every day was like going to a party. I couldn't wait to get there, and I loved working with him. Bob is predictable, never moody. He's fun, sweet, kind, good, a gentleman and a trooper. I can bounce vitriolic remarks off his big chest and they come out funny, not like acid. Because he's such a strong male figure, he makes me appear more feminine. Like everything Damon Runyon wrote, Sorrowful Jones had pathos as well as comedy. And Bob, at first, was rather afraid of the straight scenes. What if the audience laughs in the wrong place, he worried. He was feeling his way, and so was I. And this was the first movie I'd ever made with Bob. But after a few days, when he still seemed a bit uneasy, I found the courage to take him aside and say, "Don't be afraid to play it straight. If you believe in the scene, the audience will too." We started shooting, and everything went along great. Except that a horse stepped on my foot during one scene and hurt my toes so badly, I've been wearing open-toed shoes ever since. In 1949, I also made Miss Grant Takes Richmond with Bill Holden. And then, in August, a second film with Bob Hope, Fancy Pants. By this time, I had arrived in Hollywood, to the extent that directors and producers spoke of a Lucille Ball-type role when casting their pictures. When I made The Fuller Brush Girl, however, in March 1950, I began to wonder just how much I wanted to play that ball role. We got great reviews, and the bits were quite funny. But what I remember this movie for chiefly is the truly terrible migraine headaches I suffered making it. And no wonder. In filming all this wild slapstick, I sprained both wrists and displaced 6 vertebrae, then irritated my sciatic nerve by walking on the outside of my ankles for hours doing a drunk scene. I also suffered a 2-day paralysis of the eyeball when talcum powder was accidentally blown into my eye by a wind machine. A 3-day dunking in a wine vat gave me a severe cold, and I also was bruised by several tons of coffee beans. At any rate, at 5 o'clock on the last day of shooting, I was climbing into my car to drive directly home to bed when I remembered that I had promised to pose for publicity shots for the local tuberculosis society. So I drove to Hollywood and Vine, coughing and sneezing. I stood in front of the free chest X-ray machine they had set up there. The technician developed the film in a couple of seconds. "Pardon me, Miss Ball," he gasped, "but this X-ray shows that You have some kind of pneumonia.
I do? I said. I thought I just had a cold.
I drove right to the hospital and spent the next 9 days in the thermostatic pneumonia wagon. One spring day in 1950, Desi and I decided that since nobody else seemed to have faith in us as a team, we'd form our own corporation to promote ourselves. We had our manager constitute our partnership legally. Desilu Productions, Inc. was launched. It was important to find out how the public reacted to us together, so with the help of Pepito Perez, the renowned Spanish clown, and my radio writers, we put together a Mr. and Mrs. vaudeville act. Desi sang and played the conga drum. I kept trying to butt into his nightclub act. I also did a baggy pants routine with a cello loaded with a stool, a plunger, flowers, and other props, and flipped and barked like a seal. That hour-long act was a real potpourri of all our talents, like one of our Desilu goulash parties at the ranch. We broke the act in around San Diego and San Francisco at various army camps. When word got around that we were liked, 6 months' worth of theater contracts materialized throughout the USA and the Palladium in London. During a miserably hot week in June 1950, we flew the troupe into Chicago. Desi and I spent the afternoon rehearsing, and then we went to dinner at the Pump Room, returning to our hotel room about midnight. As I climbed into bed, I noticed sleepily that some of the bureau drawers were half open, and their contents were spilling out. Why did Harriet leave everything in such a mess, I wondered as I fell asleep. At 4 a.m., I woke up, sat bolt upright in bed, and exclaimed, "Harriet would never do a thing like that!" I switched on the lights and cried out, "Desi, we've been robbed!" All my jewelry was gone, including the 40-carat aquamarine engagement ring Desi had given me. Within a few minutes, our bedroom was swarming with police checking and taking fingerprints. In the middle of all the excitement, I excused myself and upchucked in the bathroom. "Don't be upset, Lucy, darling," Desi comforted me. "I'll replace everything you lost." I was sad about losing my jewelry. None of it was ever recovered. But that wasn't the half of it. I had been suffering from a nervous tummy in the morning for several weeks. That morning, it occurred to me that I might be pregnant. I was elated, nearly delirious, but I was also frightened. Now I was scared to do my act because it was so physically strenuous. In my seal act, I had to do a real belly whacker, flip over on my stomach 3 times and slither off stage. But I had 6 months' worth of contracts to fulfill. And I was so happy to be working with Desi again that I hated to call anything off until I was sure. I finished the week in Chicago, and then we headed for the Roxy in New York. We arrived on a Friday, and I immediately made arrangements for a pregnancy test, using my hairdresser's name at the laboratory to avoid publicity. Walter Winchell had once told me that he had spies in every big medical center in New York who provided him with inside tips about celebrities. Sunday night, Desi and I were in our dressing rooms at the Roxy waiting for our next show. We alternated with a 2-hour movie from morning until midnight, doing 6 or 7 shows a day. Desi was fast asleep, and I was knitting, listening to the radio. Walter Winchell came on the air and announced, "After 10 childless years of marriage, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz are infanticipating." I dropped my knitting, ran into Desi's dressing room, and woke him up. "We're going to have a baby!" Desi sat up, rubbing his eyes. "How you know?" "We aren't supposed to hear till tomorrow." I said, "Winchell just told me." "How do you like that?" was my Cuban's reaction. Harriet, my hairdresser, Desi and I did a jig of joy, shouting like Indians. I worked a few more weeks, and then we canceled the rest of the bookings and flew home. Desi began adding a $23,000 nursery wing to our $17,000 house. It was 2 bedrooms and a shiny white tile room I called the lab, with sterilizing, cooking, and laundry equipment. Desi even added an outside door at the far end of the playroom. "When our son's a teenager, he'll need a private entrance," he explained. I sat idly in the garden at the ranch with wonderful, happy plans spinning through my mind. But in my 3rd month, I miscarried. They kept me in the hospital for a week, doped with sedatives. I cried and cried, but the doctors assured me that I still had a chance to become a mother. In the next 3 months, I made the 6,000-mile round trip to New York, 6 weekends straight for television shows. I continued with my weekly radio show, My Favorite Husband, and had a painful kidney stone removed. And I kept urging my radio television agent, Don Sharp, please find a way for Desi and me to do a television show together. In October, Cecil B. DeMille offered me an exciting part in the circus spectacle he was casting, The Greatest Show on Earth. I had never worked with DeMille before, and I accepted immediately. My contract with Columbia called for one picture a year, but the late Harry Cohen, then head of the studio, hadn't come up with anything for me since The Fuller Brush Girl. "Mr. Cohen," I asked him, "please, let me out of my contract so I can do a picture at Paramount." "What picture at Paramount?" he asked suspiciously. "Mr. DeMille wants me for The Greatest Show on Earth." "Nothing doing." Mr. Cohen wouldn't let me out of my Columbia contract, nor would he let me do the DeMille movie, which meant so much to me. Harry Cohen was a hard-driving type and a ruthless fighter. He accomplished much, and if you didn't expect the velvet glove treatment, it was possible to get along with him. But this time, when he decided to get rough with me, I had had enough. I went right ahead with my costume fittings for DeMille's picture. I didn't know how I was going to outwit Harry Cohen in a legal way, but for once, I was going to try. A couple of weeks went by, and Cohen sent me a script to read. It was a Sam Katzman production, or what is known in Hollywood as a lease breaker. Mr. Katzman pictures were strictly Class E. Anyone of any stature was supposed to say, "Over my dead body, I will never do that." And then Harry Cohen could cancel that player's contract without paying them off. I had never feuded with a studio before, and I wasn't about to earn the reputation of being difficult at this late date. I picked up the phone and called Harry Cohen. "I've just read the Sam Katzman script," I crooned in his ear. "I think it's marvelous. I'd be delighted to do it."
"You would?"
Mr. Cohen almost fell over backward, and poor Sam Katzman just about had a coronary. Mr. Cohen's plan had backfired. Under my contract, I was to be paid $85,000 for my one remaining picture. My salary ate up half Katzman's budget. Harry was stuck with me. His ruse hadn't worked. So I played an Arabian princess in Sam Katzman's The Magic Carpet, a temptress whose lips and temper are hotter than the desert sands, as the promotion read. By the time I started Magic Carpet, 5 months after my miscarriage, I was pregnant again. It was fortunate that I wore voluminous belly dancer pants and cloaks because I was getting fatter by the minute. It was important to keep this fact from Mr. Cohen, for then he could have canceled my contract immediately. On the set, only Harriet knew my secret. Each night, she would let out the waist of my costume another notch or two. I collected $85,000 for a total of 5 days' work and got out of my Columbia contract very nicely. Then I went to see Mr. DeMille along with Desi. With tears in my eyes, I told the great impresario, "Mr. DeMille, I cannot do your picture because I'm going to have a baby." There was a long DeMille pause, a very dramatic pause. Mr. DeMille knew how much I loved the role and how important it was for me to appear in his picture, but he also knew I was almost 40 years old, and he could hardly believe my news. Finally, he turned to my husband and said, "Congratulations, Desi. You are the only person in the world to screw Harry Cohen, Columbia Pictures, Paramount, Cecil B. DeMille, and your wife all at the same time." His remark set all of Hollywood laughing. Everybody, that is, except Harry Cohen. I had embarrassed him and cost him $85,000 along the way. 11. This time, I decided that nothing was going to endanger my becoming a mother. I canceled everything except my radio show and sat placidly at home, knitting and waiting. The best year of my marriage to Desi was just before and after the birth of our first child. We exchanged no harsh words and experienced no upsets of any kind. Desi hovered about me, attentive to every need. I was grateful to God and in a complete daze of happiness. Desi had a yellow convertible he usually drove at 70 or 80 miles an hour. As soon as he learned I was expecting again, he began driving as conservatively as an old lady. He put up the convertible top and even rolled up all the windows to eliminate drafts and avoided every tiny bump in the road. The more conservative he became, the happier I grew. This was the way I'd always hoped our marriage would be. When I was going into my 4th month of pregnancy, CBS suddenly gave Desi the green light. They would finance a pilot for a domestic television show featuring the two of us as a married couple. A show that might go on the air that fall. What show? I asked our agent, Don Sharp. We don't have a television show. You've got a month to put one together, he answered. They want the pilot by February 15th. For 10 years, Desi and I had been trying to become co-stars and parents. Now our dearest goals were being realized much too fast. We suddenly felt unprepared for either and began to have second thoughts. At that time, television was regarded as the enemy by Hollywood. So terrified was Hollywood of this medium, movie people were afraid to make even guest appearances. If I undertook a weekly television show and it flopped, I might never work in movies again. It would mean each of us would have to give up our respective radio programs, and Desi would have to cancel all his band engagements. It was a tremendous gamble. It had to be an all-or-nothing commitment. But this was the first real chance Desi and I would have to work together, something we'd both been longing for years. We continued to wrestle with the decision, trying to look at things from every angle. Then one night, Carol Lombard appeared to me in a dream. She was wearing one of those slinky, bias-cut gowns of the 30s, waving a long black cigarette holder in her hand. "Go on, kid," she advised me, airily. "Give it a whirl." The next day I told Don Sharp, "We'll do it. Desi and I want to work together more than anything else in the world." We called my radio writers from My Favorite Husband, and together we dreamed up a set of television characters. Originally, we were Lucy and Larry Lopez. It wasn't until we started our first shows that we became the Ricardos. Desi would be a Cuban band leader who worked in New York City. I would play a housewife with burning stage ambitions. Because we had so little time, we adapted parts of our vaudeville act for the pilot. I did a baggy pants clown bit with the cello. For the rest of the show, I appeared in bathrobe and pajamas to conceal my obvious condition. Desi sang, played the drums, and exchanged patter with me. He was the perfect partner, capable and funny, and his great charm and vitality came shining through. A week later, our agent phoned to say, "Philip Morris wants to sponsor you." We were on our way. However, in the next few weeks, the deal twisted and changed and almost blew up. The sponsor had a second demand. They not only wanted a weekly show, they also wanted it done live in New York. In 1951, a show done live on the West Coast appeared on the East Coast in fuzzy kinescope, with the image about as sharp as a piece of cheesecloth. We refused to move to New York. Desi suggested that we film the show live in front of an audience. The network people screamed. A film show cost twice as much as a live one. The sponsor wouldn't put up more money, and neither would CBS. So Desi made a canny offer. In return for a $1,000 weekly salary cut for us, we were given complete ownership of the show. Originally, CBS had owned half of it. CBS also agreed to advance the enormous sums of money needed to start film production with Desi as producer. All Desi had ever managed was a 16-piece Latin band. Now, he had to rent a studio and equipment and find actors, cameramen, stagehands, cutters, film editors, writers, and scripts for 39 weekly shows. When the deal was finally set, it was late March. We had to start filming by August 15th to be on the air by October. We could rehearse and film a half-hour show in a week, but cutting, editing, and scoring would take another 5 weeks, at least. We began discussing possible writers. First comes the script, and then the interpretation and improvisations. Both of us admired and liked my three radio writers, Madeline Pugh, Bob Carroll Jr., and Jess Oppenheimer. As Jess said, "In a show that's destined to be a hit, nothing but happy things happen. God's arm was around us." As Lucy Ricardo, I played a character very much like Liz Cugat on my radio show. Lucy was impulsive, inquisitive, and completely feminine. She was never acid or vicious. Even with pie on her face, she remained an attractive and desirable female, stirred by real emotions. Lucy Ricardo's nutty predicaments arose from an earnest desire to please, and there was something touching about her stage ambitions. As we were discussing her with our writers, Desi spoke up. "She tries so hard. She can't dance, she can't sing. She's earnest and pathetic. Ugh, I love that Lucy." And so, the title of the show was born. Desi was cast as the steadying, level-headed member of the family, a practical man and a good money manager. He tolerated